Tech class. Hi everyone, my name is Aditi Sriram and I'm a counselor with ReachIV. This is a masterclass on the power of fiction that I will be discussing and sharing with you over the next 40 minutes or so. My background is in creative writing and literature, and what I've been doing with the ReachIV students is working on essays, as some of you know. And a lot of that is inspired by the kind of literature and fiction I read and enjoy. And so I'd like to share some of that with you. But let's first start with a quick introduction to who ReachIV is and why we are so awesome.
ReachIV is a boutique education advisory that helps aspiring students get accepted into top-tier education institutions globally for high school, undergraduate, master's, MBA, and executive education programs.
Okay, so there was your quick 30-second introduction to who ReachIV is. Now I'm going to give you a 30-minute introduction into why fiction is such a powerful tool that we use in our daily lives without even realizing it. And what I'm going to have us do is look at a few different passages from authors that I have read and loved over the years and whose own lives have informed and influenced and inspired their writing from the time that they were born to seeing world events happen around them, and which have now left huge impressions on us as readers today, as just people living in the 21st century and watching history pass us by and watching our present action and our current politics and our current cultural revolutions sort of unfold. So this is a fiction lecture, but fiction doesn't work just as a lecture. It needs to be something that is interactive, that you guys do along with me. So I'm going to keep showing us little passages and giving you little tiny writing exercises. So if you don't yet have a pen and paper in front of you, I'd love if you could grab one. If you prefer write on your laptop, that's fine. But quickly get just take out a piece of paper and a pen, and we're going to get started. Okay, so you should be seeing a screen that has exactly 6 words on it. And those 6 words read, for sale, baby shoes, never worn. I hope you can all see that. This is famously called a 6-word story or a 6-word memoir and is attributed to Ernest Hemingway, who's a famous American author. Some of you may have read Old Man and the Sea as part of your curriculum. Maybe you loved it, maybe you hated it. But I think technically this story doesn't belong to him. This is something that he had seen several times before in various forms of headlines, but ultimately had boasted to someone that he could write an entire book in exactly 6 words. And so here we have it. We have a 6-word story. What makes this a story? What makes this a complete story? I mean, if you look at the words and if you think about it, it's all you need to know, right? Everything that you need to know about this baby and what belonged to this baby and what happened to this baby is in these 6 words. If these are baby shoes that were never worn, well, something happened to that kid no longer needed those shoes. If they're for sale, they're probably new shoes or still in pretty good condition, which again tells you how quickly these shoes are being gotten rid of. And never worn at all, so in completely pristine condition. And voila, in 6 words, we have what Shakespeare took several acts of several plays to put together, in terms of being a tragedy. And Hemingway and people like him put it together in exactly 6 words. So what I'd like you guys to do is just take 2 minutes and try to put down 6 words that you think comprise a story. So I'm going to pause here for a moment, and I want you guys, and if you're just sitting there saying, well, okay, she's going to move on and do something next, I will, but like I said, fiction is best experienced when you guys try to do it too. Creative writing is just the most thrilling when it's your own words that you're looking at in front of you. So give this a quick try. Here we have for sale, baby shoes never worn. You could even try one that starts off with for sale, and then you could put 4 words of your own in there. So what is it like? What makes a story? What is a beginning and an ending? Give it a shot. Okay, we're back to my face again. We maybe come back to this. We'll see if we have time. But for now, just hold on to these six words. It's only six words, but they are very powerful words. And like I was saying, sometimes all you need is just a few words to convey what's going on. For those of you who have been using Reach IV for brainstorming and essay writing and have been having to work with word limits all of this time, word limits can be a challenge because either you want to say too much and you don't have enough words, or you have not enough that you need to say and you have to expand it and stretch it into that huge word limit. Either way, to play with what it means to have a word limit, to work against the constraints of the word limit, is a really helpful tool to improve your writing skills. And so in some sense, it's good that you guys have to write essays, because word limits, like I said, are a good way to sort of play in practice. But let's move back into fiction, because it's way more fun than writing essays. So why write, right? If we rewind about 200 years and head back into the 1850s or mid 19th century, there was a huge focus on puritanical literature in America. Let's talk about the U.S. for a moment, and then move into other writers. But in the U.S., you had authors like Herman Melville. I hope you've all heard of him. He wrote Moby Dick, famously. And Moby Dick is a very bipolar, or it's a polarizing book. Some of us love it, some of us hate it. It's way too long for some people. It's just right for other people. I personally love it. I had an excellent professor teach me the book, and he really found a way to bring the book to life. It is a very lively book. And what Melville was doing with this book was revolutionary. He was trying to move away from the American focus, like I said, and emphasis and religious cultural core of being a Puritan. Because at that time you had 200 years, you had 100 years worth of people who moved to the United States from the UK, fleeing a whole bunch of other things, and coming to the US to start something brand new, to start their own culture, their own fabric and way of living. And that meant being deeply religious, deeply sentimental, maintaining a very firm puritanical base. And authors such as Melville and Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne, and these are all names that I can put down in a document and share with you all after this talk. Authors like them said, there's more to life than living in fear of God and trying to live this most pure puritanical life. We need to explore nature. We need to celebrate what it means to be alive and be present today. And so, as you can imagine, this was 100 years before the hippies and 100 years before free love and the Beatles and all of that. But these guys were trying to say, let's explore what's happening right around us, what we see and experience with our five senses. And Melville sat down and wrote Moby Dick. Now, he wrote Moby Dick, it is said, in fits of seizures. He was possessed by something that kept him in his attic day in and day out, writing and writing. He didn't know what had overcome him. He had never written before. He had no background in writing. He didn't have a master's degree in creative writing. He didn't have a PhD in writing or literature of any kind. If anything, he was attracted to fiction and to the world of literature through Shakespeare, and famously copied out play after play by Shakespeare just to feel the rhythm and feel the language in his own hands, in his bones, hear it in his mind, and then say, what can I do with this music? What can I do with this energy? And out came 900 pages of Moby Dick, which nobody read. No one was interested in reading. No one was interested in picking up and trying to understand. And again, famously, Moby Dick dedicates the book to Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was, like I said, one of his contemporaries, and someone else who was also trying to explore literature and writing and expression and identity through non-biblical, non-Puritan words, terms. And Melville said, this book is for Hawthorne, who's probably the only person who's ever going to understand what I'm doing. And yet Melville had to write this book. He had to write this massive monstrosity of a book about a madman. This book, if you haven't read it, is about a madman seeking closure. And at some level, that was what Melville was trying to do. And now, 150 years later, everyone in New York City, which is where I live, carries a tote bag that says Moby Dick on it. Everyone has the book in their hand. Moby Dick is the coolest book to have either read, or not read because you hate it, or read because you loved it. But everyone knows the book. When Melville wrote it, no one bought it. It went out of print. And he is not the first author to have been published years after the fact and only then been recognized, or to have won a significant prize in literature while having not a single book in print. Another example is William Faulkner, who's a famous American author. who, when he won the Nobel Prize, did not have a single book in print because no one knew who he was and no one liked him. And of course, after he won the Nobel Prize, he became famous and now we all read him, and or some of us read him and enjoy him. But the point is, art, literature, expression, and just how our culture was receiving it have never really been synced up. It's always been one happening after the other. And what the power of fiction does is exist and echo and vibrate and resonate as time passes, so that even 100 years later, we can pick up a book and say, what Melville was talking about in the 1850s is something I can relate to today in the 2000s or in 2015. What I write today in 2015 will be something that someone else might relate to in 2150. So who knows? There's always this wonderful sense of connectivity that's completely invisible and completely not anticipated, because creativity can come from anywhere, and it can manifest in so many different ways. And for Melville, it manifested in this particular book as a crazy journey into the ocean. And just as a quick summary of Moby Dick, which is challenging to do in when the book is 900 words, but since we just talked about a 6-word story, very quickly, the book is about a captain of a ship called a Pequod, and this is Captain Ahab. And Captain Ahab has been sailing the oceans for years and years, and one fine day encounters a white whale called Moby Dick, who attacks his ship and manages to basically get Captain Ahab's leg off. So now Captain Ahab is a peg-legged pirate who is absolutely incensed at this whale for having fought him and fought his crew, while they were, of course, fighting him in order to extract oil, and will kill him and extract his oil or his fat, his sperm fat, for wicks and oil lamps. At the time, we did not have electricity. And so Ahab is sworn that he's going to go out and find this whale in the oceans and kill the guy. And that is what this entire book is about. Now, I'm going to take us to just the opening lines of the story, not narrated by Captain Ahab, but by another young boy who just happens to end up on the ship as a little sort of deck boy who swabs the deck and does all the little chores. So let me just move here, and then I'm going to read it out loud. We're going to look at it for a moment. And then once again, I'm going to ask you to do something with it. So again, I hope that you will. Okay. So I think you are now all looking at a passage. And this is page 1 of Moby Dick. It's not the first line. It is the first page, though. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos gets such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. So just take a moment and look at the words on this, in this passage and on this page. Look at the number of times we see the word whenever. Whenever this happens, whenever that happens, whenever this other thing happens, and whenever that other thing happens, I need to get out of here. I need to run and hit the ocean and just flee all of these things that make me grow grim about my mouth. Whenever I'm feeling restless and blue, or as of course Melville writes it, I feel a damp, drizzly November in my own soul. Whenever everything is gray and murky, when I find that there's death surrounding me, I'm bringing up the rear of every funeral. I mean, look at this sort of morbid passage here. And, you know, we see the emotional content that this narrator is experiencing. He says, when I'm feeling all of these horrible feelings, what does it make me want to do? It makes me want to get out, step into the street, and hurt people. You know, methodically knock people's hats off, deliberately step into the street, potentially in the way of traffic, and get hit. You know, this guy says, when I can take it no longer, I got to get the F out of here. Except he doesn't say F, because this is the 1850s, and there were still Puritans who feared God. But he gets pretty close to saying, in as stern a language as he can, I need to flee. And what we immediately get from this passage, apart from the beautiful language, which someone like me who enjoys literature and fiction, of course, was just attracted to because of the beauty and the poetry of the language, we get a certain repetition. We get from that repetition this desperation, this earnestness by this narrator to say, guys, when life gets too hard, there is a way out. And it's not what you think it is. It's not just to say, ah, I can't take it anymore, and you give up. No, you get to see as soon as you can, because the sea is a whole other world, a whole other universe, which then the book goes on to meditate on for chapter after chapter after chapter. Now, once again, like I was saying, Melville was trying to move away from living a life that existed solely because some god or creator had put it together, to say, let's appreciate nature and the real world for what it is. Let us meditate upon the sea. Let us meditate upon the land. And he, as a result, writes this 900-page ode to what the ocean is. And so what I want you guys to do now is think about motivation. What does it mean to be so motivated that you write something, or that you even read something, that you look up a book that is all about a topic that you love, and you love that book and you enjoy that experience of reading it because the motivation of the character or of the narrator is so clear. The fact that this character, page one, says to you, hi guys, it's nice to meet you. Let's go, run, pack your bag, we gotta go. I'm feeling grim about the mouth. I'm gonna go beat some people up on the street. I'm feeling violent, I'm feeling restless. We need to go, let's go, let's go, let's go. And he's sort of dragging you by your ear, by your collar, by your hand, whatever of you he can reach. And this narrator, by the way, he's a young boy, so you learn this as you go. But he's not some old man, you know, this is not old man in the sea, right? This is young boy in the sea. And he's not sitting back in an armchair, cigar in his mouth, saying, let me tell you this story. No, he's saying, we gotta go, we gotta go, we gotta go. So, think about motivation. And I want you to write just a simple sentence. And I want it to begin, whenever I something, then I something. It can be as basic as, whenever I feel hungry, I cook myself something delicious. Okay? Make it more exciting than something delicious. That's bad writing. But I want you guys to think about this, what it means to say, this is a cause and this is an effect. Cause and effect have ruled, they rule physics, they rule history, they rule all, all of our laws of nature are governed by cause and effect. It influences fiction too. And when, and this boy says in this story, in the universe of this book, the rules of this universe say that when this boy feels blue, he scrams. So take a minute. Whenever I something, then I something. I'm going to show you the passage again so you can read it one more time. And again, we're going to take just a minute, but I want you guys to really think about what this passage is doing and why it's going to make you want to turn the page. We already have a sense that this character is restless and uneasy and he's anxious. He's going to go. So what are you going to do? And what's going to make you do that thing that you're going to do? So put that together. Okay, hopefully you put something down, even if you just started to put something down or you wrote the word whenever, I applaud you. The first word is the hardest word, second word is a little bit easier, and it gets easier as you go. And like I said, I'm going to keep bugging you to write it down, because you'll be surprised when you look back at this and you say, oh, that was actually a pretty cool idea that I had, or that word. I haven't thought about that word or written that kind of sentence in a very long time. Who knows what I can do with this kind of idea? Who knows where this came from? What was I thinking in my subconscious? Why am I reflecting on this particular aspect of who I am? And fiction, the power of fiction, is to make you do that. It's to make you really dig deep without even realizing that you're digging deep. That's the beauty of fiction. And the beauty or the appeal of saying, oh, it's summer reading or I'm off to the beach. I'm going to grab a paperback, grab some piece of pulp fiction and read it and, you know, sort of relax. But then really what you're doing is you're entering an entire universe. You're entering the brain of someone else. Not only that character's brain, but the author's brain who created that character's brain. And you are taking this very complicated psychological journey that we never think about, or that we take for granted because we're just so used to it. So if you stop and think, what you just did when you wrote that line down was start to even figure out who I am, what drives me, what motivates me, why is that important? Why do I cook that delicious something when I'm hungry? What does it have to do with how I was raised and the kind of food I remember or the smells that I like? What does it have to do with what my mother or father would cook or what my grandmother would make, or the fact that I didn't have any of that? I was in boarding school and I hated the food. And you know what? I never cook anything when I'm hungry. I go out and eat. I don't know. What are these motivations? What do they say about who you are? And more importantly, when was the last time you thought about any of these things? And if you didn't, and if Moby Dick on page one makes you think about these things, then already the book has done something for you. It's already taken you that much closer to answering a deep metaphysical, psychological, biochemical question about who you are and where you fit in this world. And I don't know if a physics textbook can do that for you, or if, I won't bash on the other subjects. They're all great. But for every time that a book or a story or a line in a story makes you think, huh, wow, when was I last grim about the mouth? When do I feel that cold, damn, grisly November in my soul? Then Moby Dick has won, Melville has won, and even if he is suffering in his grave, wishing that people had actually bought and read his manuscript and his books, well, now we can, and we can make it up to him 150 years later. Okay, so I'm going to move to our next author and talk about him for a couple of minutes. Hopefully you've heard of Vladimir Nabokov, the Russian author, who wrote most famously Lolita, but has also written a number of other books and essays about writing and lectured and taught literature at Cornell University in the 70s and 60s. But prior to that, you know, he grew up in Russia. He was part of a very wealthy family that was, they had a huge estate. They had a huge farm. He was, at the age of 18, about to claim a massive inheritance from his family and live a life of comfort, luxury, and status. And this was 1899, 1900, and then was when he was born, I'm sorry. And then 1917, if you know your history, you know what happened, and the Bolsheviks revolted. And all of a sudden, there was no estate, there was no lordships, there was no status, there was no royalty. And Mr. Nabokov found himself out on the streets with no home, no property, no money, no nothing. He had already been writing for newspapers and magazines and was quite talented and enjoyed writing, but had also enjoyed the pleasures of life, had enjoyed growing up with several tutors and nannies and playing with his brother and running around and just enjoying life. He loved butterflies and nature. He was a dreamy kid. And now this dreamy kid was exiled to France with a family and lived there for some time, got married, and then fled again, World War II, and this time fled to the U.S., where he settled and lived for the rest of his, well, settled and lived for some time before retiring finally in Switzerland and spending the last of his days there. Now, interestingly, with Nabokov, from the moment that he left Russia at 18, against his will, he never owned a home after that. He lived in Paris in a rented apartment. He then, when he moved to the U.S., when he was teaching at Cornell, he had faculty housing for a while and stayed on the couches and in the homes and on the hospitality of friends. And when he finally retired, moved to Switzerland, he lived in a hotel. He never once again owned a home. He never felt like he had a home. If you can imagine being exiled at age 18, right on the cusp of coming into something grand, and then having to find your way back slowly, slowly in your own way, not only is this something that must have taken a lot of time for Nabokov to handle and deal with and get used to, it's also a trope we might have heard before. How many Hindu stories, for those of you who have read or are familiar with the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, are stories of exile? How many stories do you have of men who, or boys who left home at a young age and then had to go find themselves and along the way picked up powers? It could be Star Wars. It could be Harry Potter. It could be a number of different stories where someone left home and realized something about themselves or had to make something of themselves that they hadn't originally planned on doing beforehand. And so famously, Nabokov wrote a bunch of books. One of them, of course, is Lolita, that you may have heard about. Those of you who have read it, I'm curious to know what you think. Those of you who haven't, I recommend it. It's a disturbing, unsettling, weird book. It's about, it's about a number of things, including children and immoral feelings and affections towards children, specifically by our narrator, who likes little girls. I mean, we have to say, he likes little girls. And he tells us over the course of the book just what he did to this one little girl named Lolita. And, I mean, can you even imagine a book like this being written? Can you imagine a book like this being published? Well, no one could at the time. In fact, only his wife said that he had to have this book published. He wrote it. He was about to throw it into the flames and say, no, I can never have this published. This would make me look like a number of things. And also, no one would ever want to read it. But in fact, a French publisher, well, a small press that basically published pornographic content, said that they would pick it up. And they ran a few pages here and there. And eventually, it obviously, today, it is one of the most famous books. It is on high school and college curricula. So it is now a well-respected book. It is a piece of art. And I want us to look at it for a minute. Because I want us to see just what this character of Lolita was to our narrator. And so once again, we're going to look at page one and just look at how he describes the girl who takes up the rest of this book. So let's read it for a moment. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita, the tip of the tongue taking a trip of three steps down the palate to tap at three on the teeth. Lolita. She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4'10" in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. It goes on, but we're going to stop right there just so we can focus on the fact that this character, Lolita, in the course of the first two or three sentences of this story, has one, two, three, four names. And so I want you very quickly, I want us to keep track of time, think of a character of a name right now. Make up a character make up the name of a character or use the name of someone you know, your sibling, your friend, your teacher. And I want you to give this character three nicknames immediately. Go. They can sound a bit like these ones so that they all sound similar. They all come from the name. Or it can just be the fact that, you know, you call your friend Red because, I don't know, they like the color red, or they have red hair, or they once fell over and something red happened. I don't know. But a character and three names. Okay. This one, I gave you guys less time because it was just names. But already in the first three lines or four lines of this passage, of this first page, of this first chapter of the book, about a girl who a much, much older man takes from her home with consent and then spends the next many pages and months living with and sleeping with, we learn, so she's Dolores. That's her given name, Dolores. That's a nice, dignified name. She's Lola in slacks. Okay, so that's a nice nickname. Has a certain musicality to it. She's Dolly at school with her friends, certain, you know, youth and youngness in that word. She's just plain low in the morning when people are rushing to get her off to school. Low, hurry up. You know, you might have a nickname for a friend, but your nickname might get even shorter when you're pressed for time. But to him, she's none of these. She's something much more beautiful, much more whimsical, much more feminine, Lolita. And for him, it's not just a word that you say. It's a word that you take a trip of three steps down the tongue to recite. It's a chant. It's a hymn. It's something devotional. It's something loving. It's something obsessive and highly creepy. Don't recommend that you guys necessarily come up with these nicknames and then go flying them around. But what does it mean for a young girl to have all these different names? What does it mean that your friend is called Rahul at school and Ro at home and then, like, I don't know, something crass by you? What do all these different things say about a person? And it once again gets to the question of, who am I? Famously, in Moby Dick, the first line of the book is, call me Ishmael. That's how the whole book begins. And it's a very famous line because it's so beguiling. Call me Ishmael. Why should I call you anything? Is your name actually Ishmael? Why, I mean, is it not Ishmael? The way you say it makes it seem like it could be your name, but it could also not be your name. And now I don't know if I trust you. And if I don't trust you, why should I read this whole book? If Lolita isn't this girl's real name, what does it say about the guy who made up the name? Well, it tells us that he's crazy about her in crazy ways. And we need to maybe be a bit suspicious of who he is and what he's going to say and how he's going to describe things. Why didn't he just call her Lola? Why didn't he just call her Dolores? No, he had to have his own name for her. He had to possess her in a way that no one else possessed her. And we don't have to see any of that in the first lines. He doesn't say, I named her this because I had to possess her. He just says, this was how I called her. This was how my tongue rolled, how my tongue rolled around in my mouth, how it hit my teeth, how I sounded these syllables, how I gave it life. So okay, I get it. You're creepy. But again, the power of fiction is that in this beautiful, lyrical way, you get the hint of who the character is, who the narrator is, and who this girl is because of just all the names that she has. Think about all the things you call your teachers in school, or used to call your teachers in school. They were Mrs. or Mr. something, or Sir or Ma'am or Miss when you addressed them, but behind their backs, there were so many other things which got at their personalities. And if you can get someone's personality, you understand them. You can connect with them. You can get through to them. You transcend all the other barriers of what makes an identity, someone's name or fate or features or height or weight or color or background or ethnicity or abilities. This is something else. This is something about who they are intrinsically. And it can all come out of just how you say someone's name, how you say your mother's name, how you say the word mom when you're angry, when you're upset, when you're happy, when you're mad. It can convey so much, right? So just think about how Nabokov does this with this character. And I bring up the whole story about never finding a home because this book too took a long time before it found a home. And of course now it has a home. It has many homes. It's on the bookshelves of many, many, many thousands and millions of people. But some stories, some ideas start without a home. Some journeys start without an endpoint or even without an origin. Well, I guess you have to start with an origin, but they may start without knowing where you're going. And that's okay. Fiction says just go. Get out of there. Hit the sea. You're feeling grim about the mouth? Go. Start the story. See where it takes you. You may find a Moby Dick kind of whale. You may not. You may meet a little girl. You may not. Probably it's better that you don't. But whatever it is that you're doing, just think about how you relate and connect to the people around you and whether you call them Lolita or Lola or Lo and what that says about who you are, what your mood is, how you connect. Okay. I'm going to keep sort of moving. The next author I want to bring up briefly is a woman named Nadine Gordimer. Nadine Gordimer won the Nobel Prize in 1991. She's a white woman from South Africa and wrote a lot about apartheid. Grew up and spent her entire life there, was an introvert, loved to read a ton, went abroad for schooling, came back and was shocked at the state of affairs in South Africa, and wrote a book in 1979 called The Burger's Daughter, which is about an activist family and the daughter in this activist family. And this was in 1979 while Mandela is in prison. Famously, I don't know why I keep using that word, but famously, Mandela in jail manages to get a hold of this book. The book is banned because of all of the anti-apartheid sentiment that it contains. And Mandela manages to find it. He manages to read a copy of it and then writes a letter and sends it back to young Gordimer saying, I read your book. It was amazing. Thank you. I hope that we can talk and meet someday. And after he's released, they became friends and she followed him around while he, once he was president, and they had a very solid political and activist partnership. Gordimer and her husband hosted Mandela several times. When Mandela went to receive the Nobel Prize, he took Gordimer with him and a whole other crew of people. But let us look at just the beginning of how she begins. The Burger's Daughter, and let's do another very quick exercise. So here we go. So this is the opening of The Burger's Daughter. Among the group of people waiting at the fortress was a schoolgirl in a brown and yellow uniform holding a green eiderdown quilt and, by the loop at its neck, a red hot water bottle. Certain buses used to pass that way then, and passengers looking out will have noticed a schoolgirl. Imagine, a schoolgirl. She must have somebody inside. Who are all those people anyway? Even from the top of a bus, lurching on past as the lights go green, the group would not have looked like the usual prison visitor, passive and self-effacing about the slope of municipal grass. Okay, so what is going on here? Where are we? What's interesting about this? Who is this schoolgirl? I want you to look at two things here. I want you to look at words that keep being repeated, either the same word being repeated or a type of word that's being repeated. Perhaps you notice that the word schoolgirl shows up several times. I'm not going to tell you the ethnicity or rather the skin color of the schoolgirl, But at least the way it's being used here, it sounds a little demeaning, right? Look at that schoolgirl. Imagine a schoolgirl. Who would have thought a schoolgirl? Noticing a schoolgirl outside of this bus. And where are they all waiting? They're all waiting outside of a prison. Who are all those people anyway? Who are all these people waiting who have gotten off of this bus, who are waiting at this fortress, who are waiting to go inside perhaps, to go talk to people who are in this prison, who have maybe come out of the prison having spoken and met with loved ones? Do they look like the usual prison visitor? Well, what does a usual prison visitor look like? Well, they look, according to this author or to this narrator, they look passive and self-effacing on this grass. What kind of grass? Oh, public money grass, municipal grass. Grass tended to, not by the people inside of this prison. No, no, the people inside of this prison are reaping the benefits of this municipal grass. Municipal grass being funded and cared for by the municipality. Who needs to be in control? Who needs to judge who is inside a prison and who is outside a prison? And while we never see the color black in this passage, we see all the other colors. We see a red hot water bottle. We see brown and yellow uniform. We see the lights going green. We don't see the color of the grass, but it's municipal grass, so I'm assuming it's very well-maintained grass. Look at all these colors. Look at this bus lurching past as the lights go green. We never see the color black, but it certainly seems to be staring us in the face. And it's interesting, I would think. And so what I want you guys to do is I want you guys to just describe something, look at something in front of you, whatever it is. I want you to just describe it as visually as you can, with color. It might even only look to you right now as being one color, but is it really one color? Color is a spectrum. Is it black? Is it really black? What kind of black? Is it shiny black? If you're looking at your iPhone screen, like I am right now, it's not just black. It contains within it the shadows of other things or the reflection of things. It's faded at places. It's chipped. So maybe look at your hand. Your hand is many colors. It's many contours, and it's not flat. So describe it. Take a minute, and I want you to describe it. Okay, hopefully you took something tiny in front of you and you described it. Or even if you didn't write it down, maybe you noticed that, in fact, the yellow bag in front of you isn't all yellow. There's little bits of brown blended into there, or other colors, white or oranges, or that some of the color is faded, some of the color is frayed because of the fabric. Well, what kind of fabric is it? Have you ever noticed the color or the texture, the fabric, the contours, the shape of the thing in front of you? The way that this girl's uniform is brown and yellow, and okay, it's never described as being dull or faded, but that red water bottle, or that hot water bottle is red. That red seems much more fierce and much more powerful than this brown and yellow uniform. She seems dull. She seems pathetic, in front of this school, in front of this fortress. She seems small, let me say. She's just a schoolgirl. And like I said, we have this rainbow of colors. What is it all adding up to? What, when you put all colors together, they make white, yes, but or they come from white. If you were to take a bunch of colors on a palette and mix them all together, they'd make this murky, black, disgusting thing. And it's just interesting to me that we have this rainbow here, missing a few, perhaps, key colors. So part of the reason why I bring up Gordimer is not only is she a fantastic author, and one of my favorite books in the world is a book by her called The Pickup, which I highly recommend to all of you, is that she touched people without even knowing that she had touched them. Her book was banned, and now banned books is a whole separate story that, you know, one can lecture upon forever, and just pulling up a list of banned books would be a whole story in and of themselves. But when a book is banned, you know, when anything is banned, we're always more curious about it. We all want it. And this book was banned, found its way into a prison, found its way into the hands of Nelson Mandela, the one person who probably needed to read this book. And she writes in later essays, and she says in interviews, that his reaction to her book was one of the most sort of provocative and profound and really empathetic responses that she had seen, and perhaps that's not surprising. That was Mandela's whole shtick, was that he empathized and he understood and he wanted to find a way to make things work. And so fiction can do that. If it can find its way into the prison, then it's doing something that the laws of the universe perhaps defy. I want to close with just one final author, and then, yes, I'll close with that final author. So we touched upon a schoolgirl. You know, we've looked at some young narrators and some young characters here. I want us to think about what children's books have done and sort of their evolution. And Salman Rushdie, let's bring it back to India. Salman Rushdie, of course, we all know him. He has the fatwa against him. He has lived a wild and crazy life. And part of his story, or part of what's interesting about Rushdie, is that, of course, you know, he wrote these stories based on his own experiences in Bombay. And Midnight's Children, famously, right, which he wrote in 1981. So we've moved forward. We've come from the 1850s of Melville. You know, we went into Nabokov, who was writing in the 1960s, or before Retail was published in 1962. We moved into Gordimer, who's the book that we talked about was 1979. Now we have Rushdie. This is 1981. Midnight's Children has been published. And I want us to just look at the voice of this narrator really quickly. This is, again, the opening lines of the book. And you can see, or you tell me, silently, obviously, I will just telepathically know what you're saying. What does it sound like? He writes, or he says, "I was born in the city of Bombay once upon a time." No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. "I was born in Dr. Madlikar's nursing home on August 15th. 1947. And the time? The time matters too. Well then, at night. No, it's important to be more on the stroke of midnight. As a matter of fact, clock hands joined palms in respectful greeting as I came." Can you picture that clock? It's exactly midnight. Minute hand and hour hand are folded together as he describes it, as if it's saying namaste. And out pops his kid, Salim, who is the main character for the rest of the book. This is a little kid writing this, or telling us a story, or telling us about a time when he was young. He is much older when he thinks back, the narrator is. But we're getting this very young, childish voice, right? Can you think about what you sounded like when you were younger, or if you have younger siblings or cousins or nieces and nephews, what they sound like when they're talking to you? "I want to do this. I want to do that. No, I want to eat this. No, are we there yet? Wait, where are we going? How old is he? What color?" Oh my goodness, they don't stop. It's a lot of elliptical sentences. And no pauses for breaths, no commas. Luckily, Salman Rushdie knows how to punctuate, so that's good. We can take a breath while we read him. But Salman Rushdie was writing, like I said, based out of his own experience, but also was sort of trying to understand the world around him, because he grew up in famously a sort of secular or even atheist household where all the parents believed different things, but he grew up in this cosmopolitan and culturally and religiously very diverse city of Bombay. And out from that came this outpouring of questions and curiosities and confusions and deliberate disorientations away from conventions of religion, which of course put him in a lot of trouble. But he questioned, and he questioned through his fiction, and his fiction was so powerful that people were scared of him and people took offense. And millions of readers got hooked onto his books, and as a result, you know, millions wanted him dead, or millions wanted him alive. This book came out in 1981, like I said, and won a huge prize. And it was what put him on the map, because, I mean, this book was rejected by 100 different publishers before it finally got published. And it was only after that he wrote Satanic Verses 8 years later, he wrote it in 1988. And it was the book that got him caught. I wonder if this had come first before Midnight Children, if there would have been any notice of the book. And one will never know, because history is the way it is. But he not only, you know, wrote these books, so sort of having written these books and having had to live away from his parent or away from his family and live in exile and go into hiding and see his children or his son, his first son, only here and there, and then have a second son, and sort of when he was much older, and want to remain connected to his children in ways in which he had been, you know, stymied and forbidden when he was going through the initial stages of the fatwa. He wrote books for his kids. He wanted them to read him and not wait until they could read Midnight Children or Satanic Verses or all of his adult fiction. He wanted them to read books that were for them. And so he wonderfully wrote a book called Harun and the Sea of Stories for his first son, and years later wrote a book called Luca and the Fire of Life for his second son. And these beautiful books touch on the relationship between father and son. And the first book, it's beautiful. It's about a little boy who has to solve all these riddles and puzzles to rescue his father and find his father because his father stops being able to tell stories, and it's a very sad situation. And in the second book, similarly, the father is a very old man, and he's suffering from a number of things, and the boy has to get through all of these riddles and word problems. And it very much embodies the relationship that a writer might have with his son or sons. And so let's look at this passage very quickly, just to see how Rushdie plays with words and makes an instant connection with his son, given the language that he and his son may speak to each other and what they're familiar with, and also kind of connect with readers. There was once in the city of Kahani, those of you who speak Hindi, you know what that means, in the land of Alif Bay, again, not Bombay, and Alif, first letter of many alphabets, was a boy named Luca who had two pets, a bear named Dog and a dog named Bear, which meant that whenever he called out Dog, the bear waddled up amiably on his hind legs. And whenever he shouted Bear, the dog bounded to him, towards him, wagging his tail. So right away, instant connection between father and son. The son knows exactly what Kahani means, and he knows what the story is going to be about. Some other writers, a reader, someone in the U.S., someone in Sweden, may not know what is Kahani. It might just be a sweet, cute name. But as the story goes on, perhaps the meaning of the word Kahani becomes more apparent. And Rushdie, as we know, or maybe as you will find out if you read him, is very good at this, very good at sort of inserting words from various languages and making those meanings apparent to readers. Because why think in English all the time? Why cater to English-reading, English-speaking audiences all the time? Let's get other words in here that mean beautiful, powerful things without having to explain them, because audiences will figure it out. And children, especially, they don't follow monotheistic or just monolinguistic or mono traditions. For them, all words can work in a single sentence. All colors work in a single outfit. All foods work in a single meal. All sweet foods work in a single birthday party, right? They don't see colors and boundaries the way that adults might. And so you can do the same as you play with fiction and as you play with children's fiction, to create this magical world while keeping it, you know, based on something very real, perhaps. So what I want us to do here, is nothing. You don't have to write anything down, but I do want to just very quickly, show you how children, or just sort of summarize to you how children's literature evolved from being something that came out of a puritanical tradition, to bring it back to Melville, to bring it back to the sort of, or even earlier than Melville, back to the 17th century, when adults felt like children had to know their place in society. They had to become good adults, good God-fearing, Jesus-loving, or God-loving individuals. So they had to read the Bible. They had to know what the Bible said, but they were little kids. How did you do that? So you simplified the Bible, but you gave them verses from the Bible for them to read and memorize. And those of you who've grown up in Hindu households or even Muslim households, you've all been given texts that you have to read and memorize. Jewish households, any household. Maybe you didn't understand them at first. Now they're just ingrained in your head. Certain prayers you had to learn, certain morals you were taught. And so children's literature at first was moralistic. This was a way to teach children how to be good, how to grow up to be good people. What does it mean to be a good person? Many authors would argue that to be a good person doesn't mean that you have to, you know, follow certain rules and rites and rituals. You had a whole beat generation in America who said, no, do a bunch of drugs and figure it out for yourself. You have a lot of Indian authors now saying, let's explore all kinds of teen literature and get back into the, you know, Hindu myths, but in these new modern ways, so that we can teach our children who these characters were, but let our children experience them for themselves. So I'm jumping to the gun a little bit. But it started by being very moralistic and message-driven, and then evolved. Then we moved into this idea of fairy tales. Now, fairy tales also have morals, but they're certainly more ornate. They're more elaborate. You get to feel what these characters are like, from children having evil stepmothers to children running away from home to go do crazy things, having their own adventures, stepping into wardrobes, into kingdoms like Narnia. Alice moving, finding her way into Alice in Wonderland, or into Wonderland. Children's books became much more imaginative, and they began to celebrate the fact that kids will believe things that you say and have the capacity to embrace an imagination. And rather than just be told, you know, if you don't eat your beans or if you don't listen to your parents, a big demon will pop out of the trees and eat you. You can go into Wonderland. You can meet Cheshire Cats. You can engage in riddles with strange creatures and win or lose. And then move from that into this empowered genre of superheroes. Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, Ant-Man. I mean, now these are all movies and movies with sequels, and that's a whole separate story once again. But these were stories that the kids went out of their covers, that they loved, that they wanted to live their lives around, you know, what these characters were like as superheroes, embracing this whole new other side of them. And we've moved from this very kind of extreme or exaggerated version of superheroes to kids with superpowers who are also regular kids, like Harry Potter, like Tolkien characters, who in fact are so convincing and so realistic that they are not only characters for kids to love and enjoy, they're also characters for adults to love and enjoy. And we've reached a point now where a book like Harry Potter can be on a New York Times bestseller list of fiction for, in general, in literature, as opposed to being known as children's fiction, coming out of, you know, sort of after 200 years of books, or 200 years of literature where children were to be neither seen nor heard, and whose books were not to be celebrated, or even be recognized. Books were simply to teach them something, and today we have books that adults wrestle with and wonder about, and then go on to write fan fiction about, which is why we have books like 50 Shades of Grey, which perhaps you all have opinions on. I certainly do. I enjoyed them. I'm going to confess, I read the books. I liked, I liked part one. The rest were actually really quite terrible. But what, that came out of fan fiction, out of someone saying, oh, I really love this book about these vampires. If only there was something else I could write. Let me take one of the characters out of that book and just write my own story about it and continue this feeling that I'm feeling. I'm at sea. I'm no longer dim about the mouth. I'm back at sea. I'm experiencing something. I'm using my senses. I'm observing and I'm enjoying, and I need to continue this momentum and energy that these authors started for me pages and pages ago, or years ago, centuries ago, when they wrote that first book, when they were seething and channeling Shakespeare and writing about nature, and now here I am writing, you know, on a blog somewhere about vampires and finding followers and find people who read and enjoy my work, because we're always connecting. We're finding each other's identities. We're finding our ways of discovering Lolitas and young characters who are able to look back and reflect upon a time when a country became independent, or about someone who had to leave home at age 18 writing in Russian and then moved to France and wrote only in French and then moved to the U.S. and wrote in English, and is one of the few authors in the world, Nabokov I'm talking about, who translates his own work, unlike most other authors, and who chased butterflies in his free time because that's what he liked to do. So perhaps the bottom line of all of this is that writers are crazy. Maybe in hearing me sort of talk about this for a little while, you might feel the same way about me. I would not argue that. And I will leave you with a final thought that take the little sentences that you guys wrote down. Take that six-word memoir. Take those character nicknames that you came up with. Take that sense of motivation. Whenever I X, then I Y. Look at the other passages about voice, about that, you know, cantankerous little boy who says, I was born, well, I have to tell you, it's kind of like, let me see, it was this time, it was, well, okay, I should be specific, sort of boasting and bragging and reflecting. Take all of that, take those lines, string them together, see if you can put something together, see if you can write a paragraph, and then see if you can write a page, and then see if you can write a story about something that maybe you never even thought about writing about and has sort of emerged out of whatever you put down. And then share it, see what others think. And voila, you will have joined the ocean, or you will have entered the ocean of fiction. You will have joined this crazy current and energy of creating and creativity. And perhaps it'll make word limits and essays that much easier and that much more fun to write, because now you know where your energy and your excitement comes from. I meant for this to be shorter. I'm sorry it became longer. I will end it here. So if you have questions about Reach Ivy, please go to our website and click around. If you have questions for people who are at Reach Ivy, for the entire team, to help you with whatever it is that you're working on, please contact us at help@reachivy.com. And we can't wait to hear from you. We will be sharing this lecture and follow-up stuff on the internet You can ask us where to find it. And I'm going to sign out now so that you don't have to keep looking at my face or hearing my voice. Once again, thank you all so much for listening. I'm Aditi Sriram. I'm at Reach IV. I'm a counselor there, and I was thrilled to be able to share some ideas and passages with you today. So have a great rest of your day and week.